To see some of the people and places we'll be talking about this season, and to learn more about the case, visit our website, downthehillpodcast.com.
What does it mean to you to see this memorial when you come out here?
This intersection's tough for me. It'll always be tough for me. I can close my eyes and I can see him. You know, I can see they came from the left side over here and laughing and joking and cutting up like two young girls do probably. And then they turn left and the world's about to change. Man, if they'd have just turned right. You know, not left. Yeah, whoever it is and whoever it was has stared at this nature reserve sign just like we are right now. I know that. Even if it was first day, he stood right here. Yeah.
You're the top cop in the state of Indiana. This happened in broad daylight. How unusual is that aspect?
I don't ever remember anything like this in my entire... I've been in this business 35 years, and I don't remember anything quite like this. This is just different for so many reasons. Just so many things have caused this to be different. And it doesn't minimize any other loss of a child or of a mom or a dad or a friend or anybody, but the totality of this is different. Yeah.
Doug Carter is certain, absolute, without a doubt. We all know that murders go unsolved all the time. That's a familiar story. But here's why the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German, 13 and 14 years old, are different. We can see who did it, we can hear who did it, but we still don't know who did it. Delphi, Indiana is a small place just north of Indianapolis with about 3,000 people. They'll tell you this kind of thing doesn't happen here. And they were right, until it did.
We're approaching the bridge now. What do you see as you look at it?
Him. I can see him standing right out there. I feel the same way every stinking time I come here. Gosh dang it. You know, and then you look back this way and you see them walking here. You can see Abby and Libby just doing what girls do. Yeah, I'll be glad when this bridge is gone. Just listen. Nothing.
It's so quiet.
It's so peaceful. You know, and then what occurred right down there is just beyond evil, beyond what the human mind can understand. There's a reason this all happened. I just don't know what it is yet. I just don't know what it is. I don't know.
As you stand here today, are you convinced that this case is solvable?
Yes.
100%.
100%.
Nearly 3 years and close to 50,000 tips later, the murders of Abby and Libby, that's what their friends and family call them, are still unsolved. Investigators say the man who did this may be living among them in Delphi, sitting next to them in church, in line at the grocery store. What happened on the bridge in those woods that day?
Has he done it before? Will he do it again?
There's a lot of evidence, a lot of tips.
Why isn't this solved? Police swear they're one tip away from doing just that.
Who has it? And will they ever come forward?
Over the course of the next 8 chapters, we're going to explore those questions with the people living it. Let's get started.
Police are also examining this Snapchat photo. It was taken just before both girls disappeared.
I made the announcement that the girls have been found and it was not to a good end.
We are investigating this as a crime scene. We suspect foul play.
Law enforcement is saying that one of the girls actually took video on her iPhone. They say it was right before she was murdered.
It's amazing that we have a video, we have a still photograph, we have sound, and we don't know who this person is.
It could be half of the white males in Carroll County.
To the killer who may be in this room. We likely have interviewed you. We know that this is about power to you, and you want to know what we know, and one day you will.
This is Down the Hill, the Delphi murders. I'm Andrew Iden here at CNN Center in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm one of the hosts of this podcast alongside
Barbara McDonald, the other host.
And I'm Dan Simatovich. I'm producing this show. And before we get started, there are thousands and thousands of murders that go unsolved. What is it about this one? Why are we telling this story?
I think the answer is easy for me. It's the imagery. And, you know, I've worked at HLN since 2005, done hundreds of crime stories. And sometimes some just pop. Others just go along the rest of the way. This one, for me, the imagery, I don't remember a case having that. And that's really what jumped out at me.
And I remember those early days, and a lot of people were kind of captured by this story when it happened. And I think for me, what it was is the fact that this happened on a Monday afternoon in broad daylight. Mm-hmm. And parents always tell their kids, go in numbers, go together. You're safer that way. And these were two girls together. Yeah. And none of that mattered.
I'm coming into the story later than both of you. You were there for the beginning. And when I first heard about this and I started hearing the details, wow, how is this possible? And when I say that, I mean, there are so many things about this case that don't make sense. The biggest of which is, why isn't this solved? Because on the surface, you look at what's been put out there by authorities, the information available, and that includes a picture of the killer, a video of the killer, audio of the killer's voice. We know where this crime happened. We know when this crime happened. But somehow, this has not been solved.
It's like a giant ink blot, and the more you look at it, the more you learn about it, you see different things. It changes your perspective, and, you know, five people can look at this evidence and see dozens of different scenarios here.
It can be, literally, it can be whatever you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look at the photos, you know, someone will say, oh, I see X, and it's like, yeah, sure, but I also see Y. And so there's no definitive answers to any of these possibilities.
One thing we do know is that all mysteries have solutions. And while we're not trying to solve this case, we are trying to make sense of it.
Absolutely. And we're going to take you there to Delphi over the course of the next eight chapters. And we're going to introduce you to the people who lived this. And some of them have never told their story before. You're going to hear people who some never were asked to tell their story, and others were far too traumatized until now to be able to talk about it.
I think a lot of times in cases like this, there's a lot of focus on the family, as there should be and there is. But one of the things that's interesting, I think, about how we're going to unfold this story is that there's a ripple effect that occurs when something like this happens. And especially in a community like Delphi, you've got, you know, school kids who are trying to wrestle with the fact that there's an empty desk in their class. There are teachers who are trying to figure out, how do I talk to the class about what just happened? Because they're not prepared. So we're going to actually get out into that community and talk to some of those people. And it's really interesting to hear how this has affected them and the ripple effect that that's all had on them.
And we're going to walk some of those key locations as well.
All in the service of really trying to answer two big questions. What the hell happened out there, and can this be solved?
We want to understand.
We want to understand. We want these pieces to make sense. And as you come along with us and see those shapes and how they may or may not fit together, yeah, you're going to have your own opinions too.
And they may change.
And they will change. But first, you have to know what happened.
Part one, take a jacket.
I was at home, and I had seen that they had posted that they were at the High Bridge, and I actually told my dad. I was just telling him about how I wanted to go there and how I thought it was so beautiful, because it is, it's stunning there. And we were just having a conversation about them being there.
February 13th, 2017 was a Monday. A warm Monday, in fact. The kind of winter warm when kids don't wear jackets and parents demand they take them, just in case. It was the start of the week. Schools in Delphi would normally have been in session that day. But on this day, they weren't. So Abby and Libby had a sleepover. And our story begins that Monday morning with Libby's older sister, Kelsey.
It was a snow makeup day that day, so that means that there hadn't been a lot of snow and we had an extra day that we got off of school, so they just made it a long weekend for us.
So I didn't go in to work until like 9 or 10 in the morning.
Carrie Timmons is Libby and Kelsey's mom, and just to clear up any confusion, she lives 262 miles away in Kentucky. She's a tough woman with with a tattoo sleeve on her left arm in tribute to her daughter, Libby.
And every morning I'd send Kelsey and Libby each a good morning, have a good day, you know, Snapchat, text, message, something. And I had done that morning. Put the girls on the bus, went about my normal getting ready for work and left. And Libby messaged me back, Snapchat, and she was in her bed. And I was like, what are you doing in bed? It's like 9 o'clock or whatever.
That morning, I woke up late and planned to go to my boyfriend's house and help him clean out his truck that they were getting ready to sell. And then after we cleaned it out, he was going to go to work and I was going to wait at his house and then go to work myself.
They didn't get up until probably close to 10 or so, and they wanted pancakes.
This is Becky Patty. Before we get too far, we should acknowledge the family dynamics are complicated here. Becky and her husband Mike are Kelsey and Libby's grandparents and also their legal guardians. And you'll hear a lot from them over the course of this story. But Kelsey and Libby's dad, Derek, also lives with them.
So Derek made them pancakes for breakfast. And then later on, Libby came out. She was bored. What can we do, you know? Kelsey came out and said that she was going to her friend's house, and then she had to work.
And so I went upstairs and I started getting ready in our bathroom. And I very much remember her opening the door really wide with Abby behind her as I'm getting dressed. And she's like, hey, Kels, do you want to go to Hybrids today? And I'm like, Lib, I'm obviously getting ready to leave. I can't take you today. And a little while later, I was like, I have really been saying no to her a lot lately. So I went downstairs and I said, hey, if you can find a ride. And Grandma says, yes, I will take you. And she ended up asking Grandma, and Grandma said yes. And then she called my dad to pick her up. And that's when I agreed to take her.
And then she said that her dad would pick her up. So I said, okay. And that's when they were getting ready to leave and Libby was standing at the door. And that's when I told her that you need to take a jacket. It's nice, but, you know, who knows? You need to take a jacket. And that's when she looked at me and said, it's okay, Grandma. Gave me that smile, and off they went.
So when we left, Libby was sitting up front, and Abby was in the back. Neither of them had brought sweatshirts, which was really confusing to me. So I actually ran back inside and got Abby one of mine. And Libby had one in my back seat since she always rode with me. So I made them take those. And then we turned Heathens by 21 Pilots up really loud. And they had the windows down and we were singing to it. And it's not a super far drive. So we got there pretty quick, it felt like. And then we stopped at the entrance to Highbridge. And I made sure they both had the sweatshirts that I told them to take. And I told Libby I loved her, and I watched them walk away.
The Mononhai Railroad Bridge straddles Deer Creek. It's technically abandoned. It's rickety, and the gaps between the railroad ties are wide. But you can still get there from the trails in the area, and a lot of people do. It's all over Instagram and Snapchat.
Kelsey and Libby went out there a lot. They were both into photography and stuff. They've got all kinds of pictures that they used to go out there and take and do. So it wasn't uncommon. And we knew that there had been some other kids out there because when she had asked, Kelsey had talked to her friend, and she was out there. As a matter of fact, I thought when they went that she was still there. Derek called.
Remember, he's Kelsey and Libby's dad.
It was about 3:30. He said, I'm here at the trailhead, and Libby's not answering her phone. He said, I don't know what's going on, and that he was going to walk around. And he said, you call and see if she answers for you. So I started calling and texting and nothing happened. So Tara
is Libby's aunt.
And so Tara, I said, hey, you try. So we were taking turns trying and texting and calling, and there was no answer or anything. So by a little before four, I said, we probably need to go look for him. And Tara said, well, I'll go on. And I called Mike at work and said, Libby, they're out the trails and they're not answering. Libby's not answering our phone. We're going to go and start looking for him. And he said, well, let me finish up here and I'll be there. So I thought, well, there's two different ways if they decided to walk home that they could have come. So we drove both different ways from there that they could have possibly walked, and they weren't there. So then we got to the trailhead and I parked. At that time there were several cars there, and I had to park across the road in kind of the ditch.
And my phone started to ring, but I wasn't paying attention to it. It was on the other side of the room charging. And then it rang again, so I was like, okay, something must be wrong. So I went over and checked it. It was my grandma, and she was freaking out. She couldn't find Libby anywhere, and she wasn't answering her phone. It was really unlike Libby to do something like that. So I think in my mind, I was like, oh, she lost her phone, or she must have fallen on the other side of the bridge, because I know that they probably crossed it. Because I know Libby, but I didn't think that Abby would have, so that was a little weird to me. But I was sure that, like, there was a logical explanation, and it was just some fluke that happened.
Libby's mom, Carrie, at work back in Kentucky, gets a call.
While Kelsey and I would talk back and forth with Snapchat or Messenger or whatever, it was not normal for her to call me. But I was at work, and we're not supposed to be on our phones, so I sent her a voicemail, and I immediately, like, hid a text. I'm about to get off work. I'll call you in just a minute, or something to that effect. And she sent me a message immediately back that said, call me right now. It's an emergency, or it's important, very important, or something. So I just, without even thinking, grabbed up my stuff and clocked out, told him I was leaving, and I still probably had 5 minutes left, whatever. I didn't care. I got out to the car, and I called her back. And she, it's almost funny now. She said, actually, I think I laughed when she said it to me. She said, have you seen Libby? No, I'm like 265 miles away. And I kind of, no, you know I haven't seen Libby. What are you talking about? And she said, Mom, we can't find Libby. And honestly, I fell to my knees. What do you mean you can't find Libby?
Back in Delphi, while Anna Williams is wrapping up a shift waiting tables, her phone is ringing and ringing and ringing. Anna is Abby's mom. She had her when she was 19, and in many ways, the two of them grew up together. And some of those missed calls are from Libby's grandmother, Becky Patty.
Because I'd seen missed calls, and that was 5:30. It was kind of early in the evening. And she was like, the girls were out on a walk, and there's a whole jarble of things going on. She's like, but we're down at the sheriff's department. I'm like, okay, I'm on my way, and checked out the couple of customers I had. And I remember feeling a slight bit, like, strange, but not, like, overly panicked. I just told one of the girls, I was like, Abby and Libby were out on a walk, and apparently they're missing. I got to go down to the sheriff's department. She's like, okay, well, let us know what's going on. And, you know, just make sure everything's okay. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. See you in a little while. Don't know if I'll be back tonight, but, you know, I'll see what I can do.
Abby's grandmother, Diane Erskine, was already having a rough day.
So I went to work, and before I left work, one of my coworkers said, you know, you don't seem yourself today. Is everything okay? And I said, well, you know, no, actually, I lost my friend, Janie, today. And the kids called her Aunt Janie. She never had any children of her own, so she kind of adopted our family. And just before I got home, Anna called and said, I just want you to know the girls are missing. And I knew when she said the girls, she was talking about Abby and Libby, because I knew that Abby had gone to spend the night.
Libby's family was scattered across Carroll County. Kelsey at her boyfriend Chase's house, and Becky on the way to the bridge with Libby's uncle, Cody.
I was like, there's nothing wrong. There has to be nothing wrong. It's just grandma overreacting like always. Then me and Cody crossed the bridge and we're looking in the woods and we couldn't find them anywhere. That's when I started to realize something was really wrong. I was yelling her name so that she could hear me, and I hope that she did hear us searching. But we were doing everything we could to see if they were down in the areas we thought they would be.
Mike Patty is Libby's grandfather and Becky's husband. He's a half an hour away at work in Lafayette.
I didn't realize the urgency of it. You know, it was like, okay, Libby's not answering her phone, or either it went dead, or she's out running around with a bunch of kids, you know, doing whatever. But I did wrap up. I came straight there. And like I said, I started walking the trails as well. And then I called the police. And literally within minutes, by the time I called them and said, hey, we got a situation here, we need some help, I got back on the trails and started walking up towards the Freedom Bridge.
The Freedom Bridge is a completely separate bridge from the one at the center of this story. It straddles the Hoosier Heartland Highway and isn't far from where Abby and Libby were dropped off.
And by the time I got to the Freedom Bridge, I ran into two officers that was out there walking it as well. So they reacted, you know, just really quick. And continued walking the trails, and then ended up meeting back up at the police station at some point because I knew Becky was there.
So we're back here in CNN Center in our production room. And Barb, I don't know about you, but one of the things that's striking to me when you hear these family members talking about those first couple hours is that there are varying levels of concern. And I said earlier to someone, I can't help but think about my parents. If it were me, there would be two very different approaches. My dad would be calm, cool, and collected. My mother would be in a state of mania.
And some of that is personality. I mean, in this case, we have Anna, who isn't real concerned at this point. She's a little concerned, but she thinks maybe they're lost. It'll all work out. Mike is kind of feeling the same way. All right, I'm on my way, but this will probably resolve itself.
And then you have Kelsey, Libby's sister, who is like, no, there's something not right here. This is odd. And one of the things that jumps out to me about that is that usually the people that are younger, and Kelsey is how old at this point?
17.
They're usually the ones that are saying, no, it's fine. Mom, you're freaking out. Everything's going to be fine. So it was kind of striking that her first thought was, no, there's something not right here.
And then you have these two grandmothers, Diane already having a bad day, having lost the family friend, Aunt Janie, just that morning to cancer. And Becky, who, for what I understand, she's kind of prone to freaking out. She's completely freaking out at this point.
And so this is the backdrop and the precursor to, as everybody kind of makes their way into the woods that evening to start this frantic search.
Yes.
Part 2. Libby's Afraid of the Dark.
You're amazed. When he picked me up and we went out to the trails, we were sitting there in the truck for a little bit, and you could just see little lights everywhere. Everywhere. It was just like the stars in the sky, you know? And I said, look at this. Look how many people are out here looking.
So here's where the Delphi phone tree is about to really take off.
Right.
And people are going to start notifying other people outside of the family, friends, acquaintances, that something's wrong here.
And I'm glad you mentioned that phone tree, because in a town like Delphi, 3,000 people, it does not take long for phones to start lighting up, because Brenda calls Lisa, who calls, you know, Christine. And before you know it, everybody in town knows there's something wrong.
And Delphi is known for this volunteer spirit. So you have a lot of people who are now interested, people who don't even know these families, who are now interested in wanting to come out and help in some way.
And I think that as these families have kind of moved into, you know, that area around the bridge, you know, Becky mentions, you know, seeing all the volunteers, the more people that get involved in this thing can only ramp up the concern and the panic on the part of the families.
Right.
Because now they've got the whole town involved.
And people are posting on Facebook, two girls are missing. It's all over Twitter. It's all over Instagram, Snapchat. And this is also where Libby's phone is going to come into play.
And that's because we learn for the first time about some Snapchat photos, which we'll get into later. But this is kind of the first time we hear about those.
I think things started getting posted on some social media. And, of course, by this time, it's now dark. And people started coming out of the woodwork around town. We were looking. Flashlights were lit up, looking up and down alleys and streets. And we went all around looking, went back out to the trails. And as the night progressed, went back to the police station. I think I dropped Becky off, and then her Kelsey were going through, I think, some of the social media stuff, trying to look at computers or iPads or iPods or anything we had, trying to look for any information.
When did you become aware of the Snapchat photos?
It was that evening. I think Kelsey's the one that showed me, because I didn't have Snapchat, because she had gone on to work and then we had to call her back. And so I think she saw it. And she said, well, I do know this. So we had seen it while we were at the police station. It was that night.
What did you think of those two images, the image of the bridge and the image of Abby on the bridge?
Well, at the time, the only one that I saw was the one of Abby on the bridge. So I didn't. I mean, I saw it, so we knew that they were at least on the bridge and, you know, over. So I don't remember what I thought. I just know that, okay, they were there. We, you know, we need to be searching from there, because we know at least they were that far.
Okay. And when you called police, how did you call? Was that a 911 call?
No, I called the sheriff's department directly.
Right around 5 o'clock that evening, one of my detectives sent me a text and said, hey, Sheriff, we have two girls missing that are, you know, part of, or that live in the county. And they were last seen just outside of Delphi near the High Bridge.
Tobe Lesenby wears the sheriff's badge in Carroll County. He's got a shaved head and a powerful mustache.
I honestly was not overly concerned in the beginning, because for a number of years, anytime we've had a report of a runaway or even a missing senior citizen, I would venture a guess percentage-wise, we've probably found or located those runaways or seniors, I'd say at least 90 to 95% of the time. And so that initial thought entered my mind. I thought, okay, we'll find them. You know, we'll find them and everything will be fine.
The Delphi Fire Department is all volunteers, headed by Chief Daryl Sterrett. He's a rugged man with a strong handshake. And in February of 2017, they were raising money for a brand new firehouse. Chief Sterrett was in a meeting about that when his phone lit up.
I got a text message from my deputy chief and said that they had two missing girls and they were wanting to know if we could help search the area. So I deployed people and trucks to different areas. We didn't know where to look in the initial. They were just missing. So kind of deployed people to different areas looking for the girls, driving up and down the streets, checking maybe friends' houses, just putting more boots on the ground and doing what we could. And once the guys got out of the station, I was called to the sheriff's office, and we had set up a joint incident command.
Delphi Mayor Shane Evans was 27 years old in 2017. He's one of America's youngest mayors. And when the search escalated, he was two towns over at a city council meeting.
I drove the 25 to 30 minutes up to Delphi. I can't remember. I know I talked to the fire department. I went to the jail, talked to dispatch, some of the county units, some of the city units. At one point, I went out there when the fire department was searching for the girls at that point. Got some equipment available. We have the wastewater department has, I wouldn't call it a four-wheeler, something bigger than a golf cart and smaller than a gator. So we made that available to county and city units that were working that night if anything came up.
Here's Delphi Fire Chief Daryl Sterrett again.
You know, at this point, we'd started getting a sense of urgency. Now, mind you, now pitch black. We focused on the creek. We focused on roadside. We focused on everything we could with what we had, trying to ping the cell phone. And the information we got was, okay, the cell phone pinged off of this tower. What does that mean? Well, it could be within a two-mile radius of this tower. And so I said, okay, we need to search all of Delphi, which then includes Deer Creek, the Wabash. I mean, 2 miles out is a good ways.
Sheriff Tobe Lesenby.
Of course, that particular day it was unseasonably warm, but as it drew closer to evening, you know, it began to feel a little cooler that evening, obviously. And so being near a stream, the Deer Creek, the temperature of the water during that time period was obviously cold. You know, we have that rough terrain, so to say, very, very rural part of, even though it's just right outside of the city limits, you know, immediately it turned into a very remote terrain area. Obviously, there's hills and valleys and things like that out there.
In that evening, you know, easily we could have had 100 people searching. And then as you knock on this neighbor's door and say, hey, well, then they join the search. And so the entire town was searching in your own way. That's part of being in a small town. Everybody knows everybody, and if you don't know them, you know of them, and everybody wants to help. So we looked, and we looked, and we walked. We were focused on the bridge area, and we had people on four-wheelers. We had farmers in the area. The community was looking. We searched till maybe 11:30, 12 o'clock, and I had met up with the sheriff and discussed with him and Chief Mullins. I said, look, we have blanketed, you know, this area. I honestly feel like we could probably check it off. And he said, well, yeah, I agree, you know. And at some point, you have to do that.
As the news of Abby and Libby's disappearance is spreading, concerns are growing.
We got the call from Abby's mom, and then I was texting Kelsey on and off all night.
Erica Gibson is one of Abby and Libby's closest friends, and people confused her and Libby because they looked so much alike. She FaceTimed them the night before.
Everybody was checking different trails in Delphi just to make sure. So we came up here, and we were back there, and we even saw the firefighters back there. And, we talked to them for a while, and then they called off the search. And so we went home, but I'm glad we did because I texted Kelsey right before. And I'm like, hey, I know you guys checked around the bridge, but I know other people have too. Do you need those extra eyes? Kind of glad we didn't. You know, we were two of Libby's best friends. The other person with me was one of Libby's best friends, and I was Abby's. And so I'm kind of glad we didn't.
Cynthia Rossi is another close friend of theirs, and she didn't like where this was heading.
I think when they started mentioning the police bringing in dogs from Chicago, because I know, because from living there, that a lot of bad things happen there, and they always have just certain systems set up if something is to go wrong, and it's a very professional city when it comes to crime and dealing with crime, and they have everything you could ever imagine when it comes to dealing with that sort of thing. So when they said that they were bringing in dogs from Chicago, I was like, oh, they're going to other states. They're contacting people all across the world to try to find them. That isn't a good sign.
Yeah, definitely worried. That night, I knew so, because I went ahead and stayed with my other friend that night. We were going to go to school together in the morning. I was terrified. She wasn't so much. A friend we FaceTimed, like, was, but, like, they were only terrified because if they're still out there, they're cold. They're cold, they're scared if one of them's hurt. And really, we just thought they really were just lost and scared.
As it approaches midnight, a controversial decision is made. And for people following the case, it's still being debated.
I've heard good and bad on that comment before. I guess I will say it was a joint decision that I consulted with many emergency response leaders in our community. And so at some point, I guess the way I will put it is the organized effort by emergency services was temporarily called off, yes. But there were still people I know out, even though they were not necessarily under our leadership, I'll put it that way.
Just for people who be wondering why, you know, what was sort of the calculus and the rationale behind that decision?
There's our producer, Dan, who was in Delphi with us.
The search at that point had obviously not been fruitful. The other thing was limited at that time period, limited resources. And when I say basically additional lighting is one thing that came to mind that we didn't have access to, at least again, at those hours. And so I would, as I recall, I think a lot of it boiled down to availability of resources and being able to continue on.
We were at High Bridge. We had walked High Bridge, and we had walked under High Bridge. I had guys climb down to the top of the pillars of High Bridge. I had guys doing things that they should not have been doing, but we were going to find something. We had scoured the banks of the creek, the hillsides away. You get to a point, you know, that you've walked over two and three and four times in that area. You kind of feel like you have to put a check mark on it. So we had come to that point, and it's like I said, it was a tough thing to do, but as a volunteer department, you also have to look out for the individuals that you command because they have jobs. They have livelihoods. That's the tough part of it, because as a chief, you have to be able to look out for them at some point. And they would stay out there until sunup if you told them that's what you were doing. But at some point, you have to be realistic. We have turned every rock we could think of in this area. And that time of year, you know, the ground cover, it isn't now where you've got weeds 4 foot tall. You know, you could see a good ways even in the dark. And we have lights like no others. So we came to that point that we need to check this spot off and then look at maybe coming back fresh in the morning. You know, let's see what happens.
Abby's mom, Anna, is now starting to worry.
I remember the one moment when Becky had said, Libby's afraid of the dark. She would not choose to be out here if something wasn't wrong. And that kind of hit that, you know, something's up. And just being who the girls were and their friends, they would have stayed together. That was the concern after that, is that they weren't the kids that just didn't, you know, answer their phones and didn't, you know, respond or take off or anything like that. So that was a rough night.
One of the things that was striking to me about our conversation with Anna is what she just said a short bit ago, which was that night, it's dark, there are searchers, the flashlights, everybody's looking, and she remembers Becky saying, Libby's afraid of the dark.
And she wouldn't be out here by choice.
Right. And it was really striking because Libby kind of became a little girl in that moment. But Libby was 14. She's still very young.
I was afraid of the dark as a kid. Yeah. So, yeah, that when Anna said that, that really touched me. And it really made Libby feel very real to me in that moment. And to think about those girls, they're not out there by choice. And everybody is coming to that realization. And yet the controversial decision is made to call off the official part of the search.
Right.
Because this is an all-volunteer fire crew, and they have full-time jobs.
Right.
If they're not making progress because they don't have the right equipment, they don't have the lights they need, they don't have whatever they need in the moment, they need to go home and sleep.
And we've talked about this a lot. You know, calling off a search doesn't necessarily mean everybody picked up their stakes and went home. I mean, these guys are volunteer firemen. There's two missing kids in a small town. They're not just going to go home.
And some of these people knew the families.
Right.
And so, right, you had some of them staying, and then you had other people who showed up to help
right.
who stayed.
So the decision to call off the search, we've talked about it a lot, like how that character, like what that looked like, that may have been a situation where Chief Sterrett was just like, I can't pay overtime.
And it was a bunch of people who made the decision, and it wasn't all on one person. But yeah, and there's still stuff going on. Things are still happening out there. But that also gave them a chance to sort of get ready for the next day.
Hey, everyone, it's Dan. By now, you're probably getting a sense that we spent a lot of time in Delphi and talked to a lot of people. The great thing about that is that we're able to tell a lot of this story in the voices of the people who lived it. The bad part of that is that we have more than we can actually use. We have about 30 hours of tape that we need to get down into about 8 hours a show. But there's one thing that we didn't want to lose in any of that, and that's getting a sense of who Abby and Libby were. And now and then we want to bring you moments that really bring that out. And here's our first one. This is from Anna Williams, Abby's mom.
The girl behind that big hat and freckles was actually pretty irritated to have to go to yet another wedding and baby shower that year because there was going to be yet another wedding and baby shower because that seemed to be our family's routine. But at the same time, she was kind and considerate and loving and was amazing. I was very blessed to get to be her mom. Her headstone has a quote on the back that says, "Though she be but little, she is fierce." And she was. She might not have been forward, but man, when she decided on something, she kind of did dig in a little bit about things. And from her youngest moments, she really did not have a lot of fear about heights or anything. When she made up her mind to do something, she really did go for it. She was a good friend. She was a best friend to a lot of people. And I have a lot of stories of folks that have come to me saying that Abby stuck up for them when nobody else would. My girl had a good character to her. She would have done big things.
In our next chapter, we'll get to know Libby a little bit.
Part 3, 30 seconds later.
The night before, we thought, they'll show up at her friend's house. They didn't call in. Who knows? Next day's a little bit different.
So it's been an absolutely sleepless night for these families. Some of them went home to try to get a few hours of sleep. Others stayed out at the scene to continue searching, but nobody got any rest that night.
No, and you know, we've seen enough missing children stories, and you always hear parents talk about when the sun goes down and going to sleep not knowing where your children are and how horrible that is. And so at this point in this story, you've got a number of people who are all feeling that way.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, when you look at the timeline of this case, the search picks up again the next morning. But I remember looking at the timeline and talking to you about it and saying, why did they start at 10 a.m.? That's a little bit late.
Absolutely. And they didn't have much of a choice. There was fog in the area. They had requested a helicopter from Indiana State Police. It couldn't even take off because of the weather conditions. So the official search delayed. But still, there's people out there looking for these girls right. during that time. And that's when the fire chief gets a really important phone call from the police chief.
Got back in bed about 3:30, and I think it was 6 o'clock, 5:30, I don't know. Things were kind of fuzzy. My phone rang, and it was Chief Mullins, and he said, "Chief, we have about 300 volunteers coming to help search, and we're using your fire station as a command post." I came back in, started the day. I had a couple people from my work come in to do nothing but register volunteers. I know we were at 300. And then the people that freelance and don't check in. So we had people and people and people. Got a call from Tippecanoe County, offered up a mobile operations center. We brought it in and set it out at the bridge area so that we could more readily coordinate people in that area. And we covered everything that we had covered the night before, but we covered it in the daylight and we covered it with twice as many people.
Here's Kelsey again, Libby's sister.
The next morning, we all got up, me and my grandma got up and left about 7:30-ish, and everybody met at the fire station, and the fire department separated us into groups. And my family actually all got separated, so my grandma and Aunt Tara were in one group, and I was in a group with my dad and my other sister and a few other people. And my group got sent to Highbridge.
Todd Ladd is the pastor at Delphi United Methodist Church, and Mike and Becky Patty are part of his congregation. He'd seen Libby just days before.
I contacted the sheriff who attends our church and just said, "Where do you want me?" He asked me to come down to the command center. So my role at the command center was basically to talk with people as they came in, as they volunteered. I signed in a volunteer, of course, but more to just be connecting, listening, talking to first responders, looking at maps, wondering. Even spent about an hour with another clergy friend who went and searched a section of the creek in behind some houses, just going over areas that had been checked, but wanted to check once again. Many, many people were wanting to come out, even from communities nearby, the Logan Support, the Frankfort, the Monticello's as well. But of course, you saw a lot of people that you know, because you know many people in this community.
So is your mood on Tuesday morning different than it was Monday night when you were out at the scene?
Mood Tuesday morning is like, something's not right.
Pastor Todd's concerns are growing, and the search is reaching its peak.
So we had helicopters up. They were searching the creek. We had kayakers on the creek because some of those areas you're not going to see except for from the water. So the terrain is rough when you get off of the trail system. It's wilderness for this area. If it's not a cornfield, it's a creek bed. So even on foot in the daytime, it was tough to search.
The search continued to turn up nothing. And Sheriff Tobe Lesenby, who's a veteran cop, felt this thing shifting.
Obviously, as time continued to go along, I again had that thought in my mind about, okay, this isn't like majority of what we end up with in this county, being able to find individuals. Yeah, at some point I thought, okay, I'm not real sure about this one.
Kelsey was in a search party at the bridge when the first sign of the girls was found a quarter mile away.
We heard somebody yell up the hill that they found a shoe, and at the moment I knew exactly what they were wearing. I couldn't remember what the sweatshirt was my sister was wearing until later, but I knew exactly what shoes they were wearing. And so they yelled up that there was a black Nike, and I knew it was Libby's. And then about 30 seconds later, somebody else said that they found them.
I'll never forget this part, unfortunately. I know Chief Steve Mullen and I, and I believe the Delphi Mayor, Shane Evans, Fire Chief Sterrett, we were kind of in the back part of the fire department. And I remember, I believe it was Chief Mullen got a call, said, we've located them. And they're, you know, they're no longer with us.
It was the end no one wanted. The bodies of Abby and Libby are found in a culvert a quarter mile from the bridge. And now a search is becoming an investigation.
Because of the number of people, we wanted to get authorities to the site before we put out any blanket notice. So we kind of played coy to protect the people, to protect the scene, to protect the family. So we kind of went downstairs and played coy, and we were waiting to give notice. We wanted the family to not find out from anyone but authorities. Of course, then you start getting people, well, we heard this, we heard that. You've heard more than, sometimes you have to lie to people to protect themselves. I'm sorry. You know, you tell them, well, you've heard more than we know. And at some point, I believe it was Steve Mullins came down and said, well, we have the scene secured. Let's go ahead and let people know so we can terminate. Let's get people out of here. I made the announcement that the girls had been found and it was not to a good end. And I thanked everybody that was there. I tried to be, you got to be that guy that when all else is troubling around, somebody has to keep it together. And as I'm making the announcement, the entire lot was full of people, and there's a stream of state trooper cars going by, and it's just surreal. I knew where they were going, and I knew what they were facing.
And what those state troopers were facing was a scene so disturbing, it would stay with them forever. It was something different, something new, the horror of which would shatter lives, haunt Delphi, and grab the attention of the world. Down the Hill is written and produced by Barbara McDonald, Dan Semitovich, and me, Andrew Iden, with original music and scoring by Shuvo Sir, and production support from Michael Dudley and Kayleen Chassie, our associate producers. If you want to see the people, places, and things we've been talking about, visit our website at downthehillpodcast.com. Sherry Seldes is HLN's Senior Production Manager. Brian Bell is HLN's Senior Director of Programming. And Tyler Moody is the Vice President of the Warner Media Podcast Network. And a special thanks to the people of Delphi and the members of law enforcement who are in charge of solving this crime. And of course, most important of all, a big thank you to you. We appreciate you listening.